Hello, this is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the April 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article and an interview with Graham Nash, and an article about when the British invasion peaked, and a classic album review of 2112 by Rush. And I begin with the article about Graham Nash, titled Just a Song Before I Go. Taking his songbook on the road at 83, Graham Nash proves he was always much more than the glue in CSNY. And as he reflects on his adventures with the Hollies, Beatles, and Hendrix, and a reconciliation with David Crosby, tragically thwarted by the Crosses' 2023 passing, he reveals an upside to his enforced solo path. "I have the freedom to do whatever I want," he tells David Frick. On a bitterly cold afternoon, 3 weeks before his 83rd birthday, Graham Nash strides crisply up to a Ukrainian restaurant in Manhattan's East Village, walks in, and takes a seat at a window table like a native of New York, which he nearly is. Born in Blackpool, armed with an accent and can-do attitude forged in post-war Manchester, the singer first came to America with the Hollies in April 1965, landing in New York to join a pop music review at the Paramount Theater, hosted by the children's TV host Soupy Sales, and featuring Little Richard with a then-unknown Jimi Hendrix on guitar. 3 years later, Nash formally settled in Los Angeles to start a group with two new friends, ex-Bird David Crosby and Buffalo Springfield guitarist Stephen Stills, that the three simply named after themselves. Yet for the last decade, Nash, who became a U.S. citizen in 1973 and a full-time solo artist after the exhausted dissolution of CSN in 2015, has lived in New York with artist Amy Grotham, his third wife. Their apartment is two blocks from the restaurant. "It was always lovely to come here," Nash says of his adopted city, his accent still intact over a plate of fried eggs with chips and a couple of lattes. "Once you become popular in Manchester, you want to do the same thing in London. But after London, where do you go? New York was it. I loved it immediately." Over two afternoons at the same table, Nash reflects vividly and candidly on his American experience, the turbulent parallel passage with CSN, and the periodic CSNY with Neil Young, his painful estrangement from Crosby after the group broke up, fueled by the latter's rash, often hurtful outburst in interviews and on social media, and the daily pangs of loss since Crosby's death in 2023, as the two were on the verge of reconciliation. "I think of David," Nash says, "every time I drive through Van Cortlandt Park in the Bronx. Don't forget, it's David Van Cortlandt Crosby." Nash is frank about the belated liberty he enjoys as a songwriter and performer. Two well-regarded albums, 2016's This Path Tonight and 2023's Now. three tours with his current group in 2024, and three more set for this year, including UK dates with opening act Peter Asher, who nearly signed the newborn CSN to Apple Records. "I'm much happier alone," the singer declares. "I don't need anyone's opinion. I have the freedom to do whatever I want without having to ask three other people if I can do this." He also has the health to carry on, going meatless for nearly 7 years, exercising three times a week, and meditating twice a day. Between road trips, Nash, an avid photographer since childhood, has been working on a follow-up to his 2021 volume, A Life in Focus, The Photography of Graham Nash. And he is, as he puts it, a huge collector of interesting objects. Pressed to expand on that, he brightly replies, "I just bought the master tapes for Bob Dylan's first record." Privately held by a Columbia engineer since the November 1961 sessions. "It's like being near the tip of a flame and not getting burned," Nash explains. He recalls a photograph he bought at an L.A. gallery by the legendary New York photojournalist Weege of two women watching their tenement building burn. They had two copies, one pristine, one not. "I wanted the one where Weege wrote on the bottom, 'I cried when I took this picture. I want to touch the flame.'" What were your first impressions of this city in 1965? It was silly things like the way the phone rang, hash browns. When we got to the Paramount, the tour manager said, "Are you hungry? What do you need?" "Hamburger, maybe." 10 minutes later, there's a hamburger from Jack Dempsey's, a Broadway restaurant owned by the legendary boxer. "I remember that Times Square sign for Camel cigarettes with the smoke blowing out." "Did you see a future for yourself here?" "Very much so. In England, if you weren't John, Paul, George, or Ringo, who are you? People in this country wanted to know my opinion. I remember the Hollies were at the Holiday Inn on 57th Street, and Paul Simon came to see us. We had already done Simon and Garfunkel's I Am a Rock on 1966's Would You Believe, and they liked our version. Paul invited me to the studio with him and Arthur to listen to a few things. There was one called 7 O'Clock News, TV news reports set to the Christmas carol Silent Night on 1966's Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme. To be asked my opinion about important music they were creating was fantastic to me. But you ultimately chose Los Angeles as your next home. Cass Elliot thought that maybe Mamas and Papas producer Lou Adler would produce the Hollies. So she flew us all to Los Angeles to meet with Lou. It was like going from black and white to Technicolor. In the north of England, it was all about your job, your boss, and all that. This was sunshine and freedom. Laurel Canyon, in those days, was unbelievable, particularly after I heard me, David, and Stephen singing together. It was very friendly, and I fitted in very well. I realized I would have to go back to England and leave the Hollies. Did that feel like betrayal? You and Hollies singer Alan Clark were childhood friends. I didn't want to tell Alan I was leaving. I got Ron Richards, our producer, to tell him. I'd known Alan since I was 6. I should have been a better man about it, but I wasn't. At the same time, I'd written Marrakesh Express, and thought it was a decent song, that it would make an interesting single. But the Hollies didn't like it. Somewhere in the bowels of EMI is a track of the Hollies doing Marrakesh Express. No vocals, just the track. But it has no train in it. No chug, it doesn't feel right. But I'd met David, and he told me it was a very decent song. Those are the guys that are crazy, not you. And here's a little bit of that song, Marrakesh Express, by Graham Nash.
Looking at the world through the sunset in your eyes, traveling the train through clear Moroccan skies. Ducks and pigs and chickens call, animal carpet wall to wall, American ladies 5 foot tall and blue. Sweeping cobwebs from the edges of my mind, had to get away to see what we could find. Hope the days that lie ahead bring us back to where they've led. Listen not to what's been said to you. Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? They're taking me to Marrakesh, all on board that train.
Has your relationship with the songs from your CSN and CSNY history changed? Those other voices are no longer there when you perform them now. I know what people want to hear from me. They want to hear Teach Your Children and Our House, Military Madness and Immigration Man. It's incredible how relevant some of these still are. I mean, Immigration Man, it could have been written this morning. Military Madness, look how many wars are going on right now as we're speaking. It's insane. I must have touched a nerve somewhere. I'm doing them a little differently now. From this point of view, I tell people what I was feeling when I wrote them. I tell them how when I wrote Teach Your Children and played it for Stephen, he said, "That's a really great song. Don't ever play it like that again." What? You sound like Henry VIII. This is how it should go. And he put that incredibly right-hand picking pattern in there that Stephen is so famous for. And here's a little bit of that song by Graham Nash, Teach Your Children.
Out on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh.
What do you miss about CSN or CSNY, if anything? I miss witnessing greatness. When you stand in the middle of Stephen and Neil, and they're talking to each other on their guitars, or Crosby singing the shit out of one of his songs, there was a certain magic that is not there anymore. It's been replaced by other kinds of magic when I perform. But I miss seeing that creative streak spontaneously happening in front of me. What was the balance of power in that magic? The dynamics, for example, of how you decided who got what songs on an album? Well, there were some unspoken plots of power. We didn't know that Neil said, "Don't film me," at Woodstock in 1969. We didn't know until the movie came out. Seriously, he never told me or David or Steven. Those kind of moments are interesting in retrospect. Sometimes I think that the best thing that ever happened to CSN was Neil. And maybe the worst thing that ever happened to CSN was Neil. Looking at Deja Vu, Country Girl and Helpless, we got from him. But we already had Carry On, Our House, Teach Your Children, and Almost Cut My Hair. If that had been the second CSN record, maybe we'd still be making records. You were seen as the peacekeeper in that den of egos. Were you overlooked as a songwriter, fourth among equals? I never thought I was equal to them, never. It's David, Steven, and Neil. Listen to what the fuck they do. I'm not that person. I can play guitar and piano, good enough to write my own songs. I can play Young's Down by the River and any of David or Steven's songs, but I never put myself equal to them as a musician. I was born in 1942. World War II still had years to go. And the basic English thing was, we can do this. That's why people think I was the glue or the peacemaker. Because in many ways, I was. I said, we're going to do a new record. Let's fucking do it, and do it the best we can. And it wasn't in your constitution to be as nutty as the other three? No. But I was part of some great music, and I love what I do. That's better than most people ever feel. I just want to do the best I can, to be the best father, the best musician, the best man. I'll never make it. But I'm trying my best always. I can't remember when my world was not on fire, Nash sings on Now, in a song called Stars and Stripes. It is the literal confession of a war child. Nash's earliest memory, he says, is of me in my crib, watching my mother pull the blackout curtains to thwart German bombers flying over Manchester. He suggests that if America had been bombed like Manchester and Liverpool, it would be a very different country today. And here's a little bit of that song, Stars and Stripes, by Graham Nash from his new album titled Now.
Sometimes I wonder why the world is like it is, frozen by the fear of change. If we keep believing all the lies meant to divide us, there's no one else that we can blame. Remember when my world was not on fire, where people lived in fear and flames. I sit here watching as the fire keeps getting higher, burning up the mountain range.
Coincidentally, the day before our first interview, Nash found a photograph of the room I was born in, a dining room of the Kimberley Hotel in Blackpool, two or three blocks from Blackpool Tower. I took my two boys, Jack and Willie, to that room, and I have a photograph of them there where I took my first breath. Nash got his first camera in his early teens, bought for him by his father, William, a present with a price when it turned out the camera was stolen. William, who refused to give up the friend who sold it to him, spent a year in prison. That's why I left school, Graham recalls. I had to become the man of the family. I would make sure the fire was dampened down so it wouldn't burst into flames during the night. I'd make sure the dishes were done, the front door was locked, and the lights were out. Normal stuff. He and Clark were bestowed with Skiffle when they first harmonized in the late 1950s. Aping their vocal heroes, the Everly Brothers, as Ricky and Dane Young. By 1962, they were in a band, the Deltas, that changed its name to the Hollies, after another idol, Buddy Holly, according to Nash, before a December show at a Manchester spot called, ironically, the Oasis Club. A year later, the Hollies were in the UK Top 20, a residence that ran into the 70s, long after Nash quit. It's odd, Nash says now. A recent article in the New York Times about historic venues in Manchester cited Oasis, the Stones, Roses, and the Smiths. And the Hollies were not mentioned at all, not one word, he laments. What happened? Maybe we weren't cool enough. We were quite happy watching people shake their asses off while we played. Maybe that's it. But it really shook me how much the Hollies were not appreciated at all. You grew up in the aftermath of war, the perpetual gray of rebuilding and rationing. What was the first music that gave you hope and the ambition to make it yourself? Well, I worked at a record shop on Saturdays. I remember walking from my house to the store in a fog, and I heard Blue Moon by Elvis from Presley's 1956 RCA debut LP, Coming From Somewhere. The first record I got for myself, I traded 3 pieces of toast to a friend at school for Gene Vincent's Bebopalula. And here's some of that song, Bebopalula, by Gene Vincent.
She's my baby, Bebopalula. I don't mean my baby, Bebopalula. She's my baby, Bebopalula. I don't mean my baby, Bebopalula. Well, she's the gal in the red blue jeans. She's the queen of all the teams. She's the woman that I know. She's the woman that loves me so. Say, Bebopalula, she's my baby.
You got the better of that transaction. Yeah, I did. Later, when I was looking for a new solo deal, I told Capitol I'd sign with you if you leave me with my original 2-track tape of Bebopalula in your studio and let me play it loud, and they did. Your time and success with the Hollies, the signature harmonies, the hits you wrote with Clark and guitarist Tony Hicks, the stress and division that ultimately drove you to leave, was good practice for everything that would hit you in CSN and CSNY. Ron Richards, what a great producer he was. He knew when a take was a take and when we should have done better. We made our first LP, 1964's Stay with the Hollies, in an hour and a half. We did our 45-minute set, did it twice, and he chose the album from that. It was only a 3-piece band, drums, bass, and lead guitar, Tony Hicks, God bless him, a great guitar player, and what a fantastic ear he had. He would go to the publishers and say, "We're going to record in 2 days. What have you got?" He found Just One Look by Doris Troy, Here I Go Again, and Bobby Elliott was a great drummer, still is. When you, Clark and Hicks, started writing, you credited the songs to L. Ransford, your grandfather. I just thought that was what you did. L. Ransford. Handsome dude. Was he aware of how many songs he wrote? Not at all. I don't even think my parents were aware. My father died in 1966. The Hollies had been successful for 2 years by that time. Had you outgrown your bond with Clark when you teamed up with Crosby and Stills? Well, it was mainly the writing. I like Nina Simone's quote, "Every artist needs to reflect the times in which they live." I wasn't doing that with the Hollies. I was writing On a Carousel, Carrie Ann, nothing contemporary. At the same time, I'd heard me, David, and Steven singing. I said, "Okay, that's my past. This is my future." And here's a little bit of the song Carrie Ann by the Hollies.
Monitor. Then you played with older boys and prefects. What's the attraction in what they're doing?
Hey, Carrie Ann, what's your game now? Can anybody play? Hey, Carrie Ann, what's your game now? Can anybody play?
You're always something special to me. Quite independent, never caring. You lost your charm as you were aging.
What do you think your future might have been if you had stayed in London after leaving the Hollies? You were well set in the scene, turning up at Beatles sessions. Paul McCartney called me one day. "Do you want to come down to EMI?" "Why? What are you doing?" "Oh, we're going to play for 4 billion people," I said. "How are you going to do that?" It was this satellite thing. All you need is love. And you contributed foot stomping to If Six Was Nine on Hendrix's Axis Bold as Love. Well, I was staying at an apartment with Gary Leeds, the drummer in the Walker Brothers. He knew Jimmy, and I had shared an apartment with experienced drummer Mitch Mitchell for about 8 months. So Gary and I got invited down to Olympic Studios. Jimmy said, "Can you walk?" "What do you mean? Of course I can walk." He said, "Okay." He put a piece of plywood down and said, "Walk in rhythm with this." I don't know what I would have done if I had not joined David and Steven. I wrote Cold Rain on 1977's CSN about that. I'm stuck in a hotel in Manchester in the rain, watching these people walk by who hate their bosses and their work. And I think, why me? My mother once told me, follow your heart. Your heart knows what's good and what's bad. I've always done that. That's why I love good music, why I want a piece of a great song, and why I took the courage to leave the Hollies, a very successful band. I followed the magic of the music. I heard me, David, and Steven singing. I don't know what else I'd be now. It started with a voicemail on Nash's phone. Crosby leaving a message of apology and hope for amending after several years of acrimony and rigid silence. I wrote back to him, Nash says, remembering every step of their final exchange. I said, David, I'm still hurt by what you said. I don't know. Crosby left another voicemail. Please, let's talk. Nash set up a FaceTime call because I wanted to look into his eyes while I was talking to him. Crosby, a drug abuse and liver transplant survivor who continued to fight health issues while mounting a stunning solo album renaissance in his last decade, died before they could speak on January 18, 2023. He was 81. Nash takes a long moment to respond when asked what he would have told Crosby on that call. I think, he says finally, that really small things got in the way, small attitudes. Crosby was a brilliant musician and thinker, and his own worst enemy. When David was joyful, the entire room lit up, but it could be instantly darkened by something he said. Nash recalls Crosby threatening a woman who worked for CSN's backstage catering with a fork because he couldn't get real butter. Yet, he was hilarious sometimes, Nash insists. Once, at a meal in Australia, he ordered steak tartare well done. Doesn't he understand tartare means not cooked? Nash laughs fondly. Silly thing. He, Stills, and Young remain in touch. Nash was in the loop as the others curated the 2024 CSN release Live at Fillmore East, 1969. But Nash reiterates something he has publicly avowed on several occasions since his passing. Crosby was the very heart of CSNY. Without him, he contends, the survivors will never play together again. I miss David terribly, Nash admits. We had a couple of years that were a little nasty, but towards the end, we were getting together and saying, hey, come on, what the fuck? What are you trying to get across in your shows now? For most of your career, people have seen you as part of a bigger entity, one of the most successful bands of all time. What I want to accomplish is a couple hours of relative peace for all of us, for myself, the band, and particularly for the audience. It costs money to see a show, and the world is so chaotic right now, I just want them to be part of something that is peaceful for at least 2 hours a night. The truth is, I sing a lot of my songs now with the knowledge that it might be the last time. At 83, how much longer? Hopefully, it will be a few more years. But you never know. When you're young, you never think about this time of life. When you get here, you do. Meditation helped me realize that what I've done with my life has made a lot of people smile and dance. I tried to do the best I could with whatever talent I'd been given. Why did you have to go through so much strife in order to make people feel so good? You wrote Wasted on the Way on 1982's Daylight Again about all the magic that CSN wasn't making because of the egos and drugs. I'm still pissed off that we didn't do enough. When Crosby, Stills, and Nash first signed with Atlantic, it was for 6 albums, 1 a year. We didn't reach 6 studio albums until 1990. There was a lot of time wasted and a lot of music wasted. That's why I wrote it. And here's a little bit of that song, Wasted on the Way, by Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Look around me, I can see my life before me, running rings around the way it used to be.
When you presented the song to Crosby and Stills, what was their reaction? They understood that it was a decent song and we could make a good record of it. Whatever feeling they had about what I said were unspoken. They knew they must agree. It was always about the song. We had a rule. If I play them a song and they don't like it, you never hear that song again. If it's worth it, I'll keep it for myself. But it doesn't get done by the three of us. Sometimes that rule works well. Sometimes it doesn't. For instance, the album we did with Neil, 1988's American Dream, there was a song of David's called Climate. That was fucking fantastic. But Stephen didn't feel it, so it never got out. We got a great track of it. It never made it to the final record. How do you look back on your career now, the whole ride? People have asked me, what would your epitaph be? And I go, well, I tried my best. What else can you say? I achieved what I wanted in the Hollies. We loved it that people danced, and I've never lost that feeling. I want the audience to be part of it rather than looking at me. Join in. Sing if you want. Some members of my band don't like that at all, people singing those songs. But if somebody in the audience wants to sing, that song must have meant a great deal to them. Who the hell am I to not have them sing? The amount of people who tell me they've had Teach Your Children play at their weddings, that's fantastic to me. I really believe in what I achieved, and I want to do more. Now the article titled, The British Invasion Peaks. Spearheaded by the Beatles' success in early 1964, the USA's love affair with Anglo groups cranked into overdrive, and by May 1965, 8 of the top 10 were by British acts. But what was the experience really like for the Zombies, the Dave Clark Five, Petula Clark, and others as they crashed headlong into America? They went crazy, recall participants and witnesses 60 years on. The screaming was like a jet plane taking off. Here's Jeremy Clyde. The Beatles broke through in 1964, and all the A&R men in America came rushing to England. We, Chad and Jeremy, had gone on Jukebox Jury with Ringo on the panel. Everybody voted our track a summer song, a miss, though Ringo said it's a bit soft for England, but I think it might be a hit in America. And so it proved, reaching U.S. number 7 in October 1964. Here's a little bit of A Summer Song by Chad and Jeremy.
Trees swaying in the summer breeze, showing off their silver leaves as we walked by. Soft kisses on a summer's day, laughing all our cares away, just you and I.
Petula Clark. I was touring in Quebec, singing in French. We kept getting these calls from Ed Sullivan, and my husband, Claude, would say, what does he want? This man, what is he? You know, I think it's important. Colin Blundstone, the Zombies, who'd reached U.S. number 2 in early December with She's Not There, played Murray the K's Christmas 1964 shows at the Brooklyn Fox Theater for 10 days with the Shangri-Las, Patti LaBelle, and the Bluebells. Benny King, Chuck Jackson, and two English bands, the Nashville Teens and the Hullabaloos. The American acts were very friendly and welcoming. There was a fine camaraderie because everyone was away from home over Christmas. And here's some of that song by the Zombies, She's Not There.
Well, no one told me about her, the way she lied. Well, no one told me about her, how many people cried. But it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she had turned the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there.
Petula Clark. The first time I sang Downtown live in front of an audience was in New York for the Ed Sullivan Show. I arrived from Paris totally jet-lagged, and my plane was late. I walked on stage, and the orchestra was playing the introduction much too fast, but the audience didn't seem to mind. As soon as they heard it, and as soon as they saw it was me, they went crazy. I was only there to sing one song, and it was the song that they all wanted to hear. Downtown, U.S. number one in January 1965, was the anthem for New York, and the New Yorkers loved it. And here's a little bit of that song, Downtown, by Petula Clark.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose? The lights are much brighter there. You can't forget all your troubles, forget all your cares. So go downtown. Things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure. Downtown. Everything's waiting for you.
Colin. New York was very loud and vibrant, hard-edged, and a bit scary, with an undercurrent of violence. Police sirens going all through the night. On New Year's Eve, two of the Zombies, Chris White on bass and Hugh Grundy drums, were out in Times Square and saw a policeman shoot somebody. Jeremy, we were booked on the Hollywood Palace show, the West Coast rival to Ed Sullivan. When the airplane landed in L.A., the stewardess said, "Guys, let the others off first. There's a bit of a reception for you." We're going down the freeway, surrounded by cars filled with young women in a state of great overexcitement, getting as close as they could to touch our car. The chauffeur was absolutely terrified. We got to the entrance of the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, and cars piled up on the pavement as we ran for the entrance. Filling the doorway was a wedding party, and we went straight through them, followed by a lot of young women. The Beverly Wilshire security kicked in, but we got up to our suite, and there's a couple in a laundry basket. Cynthia Albritton, who's a fan. How do you find a band? You call up the likely hotels and ask to be put through to one of them. The second hotel call connected me to Brian Jones's room, and as soon as I heard it ringing, I knew I'd hit the jackpot and hung up. Colin, in Chicago, hundreds of young girls were running around the hotel corridors looking for the Zombies and the Searchers who were touring with us. The hotel manager said, "I'm really sorry, but you have to leave. We can't control what's going on." Keith Hopwood, part of Herman's Hermits. Dick Clark had a TV show, American Bandstand, and he put out package tours, the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars. For 3 weeks, Herman's Hermits would do a show. Then we'd get back in the bus and drive all night because the next gig was so far away. Herman's Hermits hit U.S. number 2 in March with Can You Hear My Heartbeat, one of 5 top 10 hits that year. Dave Clark. With the Dave Clark 5, who'd had 3 top 10 LPs and 7 top 10 singles by the end of 1965, flying between shows could be scary. Once, as we were taxiing to take off from San Francisco, a Boeing 707 was mistakenly cleared to land at the same time and ripped off half our wing. Fire trucks roared up to cover the fuel, pouring out in foam. Once, as we were arriving in Memphis, I was sitting in the cockpit and watched in horror as hundreds of fans broke through the police barriers and ran onto the runway in front of the plane just as we were touching down. With only seconds to spare, we had to abort the landing and pull back up again. Everything in the overhead lockers crashed on top of the boys. It was really frightening. Jeremy, we did a split bill with the Beach Boys, and they had a plane. Al Jardine and I played chess across America. Keith, headlining the Caravan of Stars tour from April to June 65 with 13 acts. Some of those guys were quite sizable, so I took up more than one seat. One morning, something had gone on in the night with R&B performers Billy Stewart and Round Robin, who was equally large, and one of them was waving around a 45 as the other got on the bus. We rang the Dick Clark's offices and said, "Look, just get us out of this." From then on, we went by station wagon. Cynthia, half of the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars were black artists, and down south, there were hotels where we couldn't stay and restaurants we couldn't eat. This was a real shock. Once I came into the hotel with my arm around Carolyn Gill of the Velvettas, our tour manager came over and said, "Some guys have just said, if you continue acting like that, you will get shot." They weren't joking. Keith. We started out in theaters, and by the summer, it was 10,000, 15,000 sports places. It took a lot of people on our side by surprise. We had one roadie, and the security usually consisted of a couple of local cops. We'd just hole up in the hotel or motel. The kids would find out well in advance where you're going to stay and populated the lobby. We couldn't go out anywhere. Colin, massive crowds would queue round the block, and you couldn't move outside the theater. Our lead guitarist, Paul Atkinson, did go out of the stage door once and was surrounded, pushed up against a plate glass window, and had the shirt ripped off his back. The police pulled him out, saying to him, "We'll do this once, but we're not doing it again." Angie Urigo, I started babysitting for a couple who got me tickets to go see an all-British tour. Chad and Jeremy, Peter and Gordon, Freddie and the Dreamers, Jerry and the Pacemakers. I wasn't a screamer. I only ever stood on my chair to see because everybody else was standing on their chairs. Even as a 13-year-old surrounded by thousands of people screaming, you couldn't hear the band. Jeremy. I'll never forget the sound of the screaming like a jet plane taking off. But it also leads to cynicism because they can't hear what you're doing. And we couldn't hear what we were doing. There were no monitors in those days. Dave Clark. Our U.S. tour opening acts were often artists who had inspired us. Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Little Richard were our idols and should have been top of the bill. I was standing in the wings at one show watching one of our support acts, Roy Orbison. He walked on stage in dark glasses with a guitar and seemed to possess no charisma whatsoever. This is going to be boring, I thought, but as soon as he opened his mouth, I got goosebumps. That voice. Tula Clark. I think a lot of Americans didn't know I was British, like they didn't know Tom Jones was Welsh. You didn't have the audience hysteria as you did with the boy bands. I think they looked on me as like a big sister. Keith. On the road, just as Herman's Hermits were at U.S. number one with Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter, in May 1965, Bobby V introduced us to these things called cherry bombs, like a gobstopper with a fuse. We used to throw them out of the car window, out with the Who. A couple of years later, was introduced them to Keith Moon and John Entwistle, who roomed together. What happens if we stick three down the loo? They blew the whole thing off the wall. Dick Clark. The boys and I were winding down in the basement nightclub of Delmonico's Hotel on Park Avenue after a show in New York in June 1965, and the sound system kicked into this record I'd not heard before. It had a fuzz guitar riff, which was a dirty new sound, an incredible rock solid backbeat, and all I could make out of the words were, "I can't get no." I shot over to the DJ to ask who it was, and when he told me, it was the new record by the Rolling Stones, I was amazed. When I Can't Get No Satisfaction hit number one on July 10th, 1965, the British invasion reached its peak. And the classic album review this week is 2112 by the band Rush, 1976. Half hard rock thumper, half concept album that spawned numerous sci-fi metal imitations, side one features Alex Lifeson tuning up in a cave. Some collective consciousness has decreed that Rush be eternally unhip, but the Toronto band's fourth album was an instantly intriguing gambit. Side one, the concept side, was heavily influenced by the novelist and philosopher Ayn Rand, and imagined a futuristic society ruled by priests who had banned musical instruments as the setting for an examination of human free will. Lyricist Neil Peart's penchant for extended ruminations had been established on 1975's Caress of Steel, but if this was a poor seller, which left the band with everything to prove, 2112 was brilliantly executed reposite. I grew up in the suburbs, and it was all very prosaic and dull, says Peart of the sci-fi fascination he shared with a large portion of his audience. So I started getting interested in all those kinds of things just in the belief that there must be more interesting world out there. Consequently, you get tied up in all that. And whether you believe it or not really doesn't matter. It becomes an escape. I can understand it from the kid's point of view, having been that way myself. And as a writer, fantasy is really an excellent vehicle for expressing ideas in their purest sense, without any preconceptions. There's nothing better than having your own made-to-order extraterrestrial world. Much of side two offer more traditional fare, a lyrics of A Passage to Bangkok, later a live favorite, read like a hash menu at an Amsterdam cafe, and Something for Nothing, the kind of song which would later prompt Pavement's Steve Malcolmus to wonder how Geddy Lee's voice got so high, works its magic with little more than a few power chords. Here's some of A Passage to Bangkok by Rush. The album also saw them lay the foundations of a sound which would establish them as one of the premier hard rock acts of the 80s and 90s. Fans of 2112 include Beck, who used to play live with a sticker of the Rush Star logo on his guitar. By November 1977, the album was certified gold, and by November 1995, triple platinum. And once again, unfortunately, we're all out of time. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the April 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article about the band Television, and then How to Buy Boz Scaggs, and a classic album review of the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long, and keep rocking.
Smoke.